Let's tidy up this tangle of film by putting it on a reel. Here is a motion picture film, 1,000 feet, 16,000 separate photographs.
Welcome, everybody, to the official space section of the charter.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Sir, you're out of order.
Out of order? I show you out of order!
So, did you have a chance to go over the topic?
I did. Yeah. Had a look through. I mean, I was assuming that this wasn't going to be like an exam. We don't necessarily need to touch on all that stuff. If stuff comes up, yeah, for sure. But great questions. What's been really cool about this this process? And I wish I had hired a publicist for when I was on Reacher. In my discussions with sort of everyone that I've been talking to, there's a real gap. In the acting scene in terms of like business acumen for Canadian actors. Now, I taught acting when I was in Toronto. The issue is that most people never get good enough at the art of acting to worry about the business of acting, right?
Totally.
But what I'm finding now is like, and this is going to sound super silly, but like I'm the most successful person that I know. Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I know Ryan Robbins and stuff, but he's a, you know,
yeah.
Rungs and rungs and rungs above me on the ladder.
You're a small pond kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I would say medium fish. Pond. Yeah.
You've been working. Don't discount.
Yeah. But the only person I've ever known that has hired a publicist is my good friend Teague Fong, who got nominated for an Emmy twice. And so he was advised, you know, by his agents to be like, oh, you should, you know, because you need an Emmy campaign, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, all that to say, you know, I just assumed that the work would be enough, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's not. And especially now when there's so much noise, like how much background noise is there now, right? So that's why, I mean, that term breaking through has always been around, but you really, really have to work at kind of breaking through, which sort of goes back to what I was saying before about sort of this lack of business acumen. I feel that Canadians inherently, not necessarily, but generally shy away from competition. Whereas I feel that Americans lean into that. And so That's sort of what I have to remind my Canadian acting students. It's like, listen, you are competing against people that want to be at the show, right? And Americans confuse our politeness for weakness. All of that like self-deprecating humor, like the, oh, sorry, can I use a sorry? You can't, you can't do that.
Don't be apologetic. Get your foot in the door. Like,
don't do it.
Fight,
don't
scrap, do it. Fight for it. Yeah.
No. Yeah. Exactly. Like, yeah. Not, sorry to cut you off. It's not about stepping on other people's heads. I'm not suggesting that you need to be a sociopath, but there's that great Steve Martin quote where it says, just be so good that they can't say no.
I agree with that. I that quote is in, if I could turn the camera around, that quote is on the chalkboard wall behind the computer. Okay. Because it make your own noise, right? Like, and it, I mean, whatever you do, but make enough noise that they're just like, we can't avoid this person anymore. We need to give them something. Like, they're on the radar. Look at who likes them. Look at who's following them. Look at, as much as that sucks, but look at who's paying attention. If we don't, we're going to miss out. Yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's sort of like, I mean, people want to help people that are helping themselves, right? So it's tricky as an actor because you're basically just cap in hand, like, please, sir, can I have a job?
Oh, hello.
But that's, it's difficult. That's not attractive, right? Because it's sort of like
needy.
It is, right? And it sort of ends up being like, there's a weird power dynamic. So it ends up being like that, like in dating and stuff, right? There's that kind of give and take, right? So I think as actors, we really, you have to change that mindset, right? And there's so many great quotes out there. Bryan Cranston, Michael Keaton, sort of talking about how you have to think about auditions, not as a job interview, right? It has to be something else, right? But in terms of like, you have to bring value. That's what I tell actors, right? You need to be valuable. And so what I've tried to do, you have to diversify now. The industry only wants you to be one thing. They really only want you to be one thing.
Whatever they like, so hit it.
Yeah, exactly, right? But if you have other skill sets, I think you do need to lean into it, right? So voiceover was something that I had tried to kind of move into, and that's a real hard nut to crack. The people that do that do it all the time are just, I don't think people realize how good professional voiceover actors are at their craft.
Dave,
but that
I completely agree. Like it's an ignored art because you're just like there's nothing to see. Me the fan, we don't get to see how much practice goes into getting the tone and
100%, yeah.
Reading it on command. Like you can take a scene and, you know, if your direction is okay, play it a little stronger, okay, play it a little sadder. All right, I can do that because I have a tool belt. But with voice, it's literally just the voice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you know, right? Like this is your arena, right? You're a voice person, you know what I mean? So you understand what I'm saying. But stunts sort of ended up becoming that sort of secondary, that branching out, that diversification that I was looking for, that voice didn't really sort of lend itself. And I just, do you know what it was with the voiceover stuff? Is that you get so much rejection from the acting side. I couldn't handle more rejection from that side.
Like what's different about the audition for a character in a feature versus voiceover?
No, it's identical. But the thing is, because I'm classically trained and I've been doing, you know, like stage and screen acting for so long, like I can take it. Acting is rejection. There's no two ways about it. And I'm okay with that. But when I was moving sort of into that sort of new space of voiceover stuff, I couldn't take those knocks. You know what I mean? I don't know why. I was like, I'm willing to fight this fight over here, but I'm just not willing to fight this over here.
Well, I mean, it is a different aspect. It's a different rung of the ladder. I mean, not in terms of value, but just in terms of where you want to be in the industry. Do you want to be in voiceover? Do you want to be in features? Do you want to just be directing indies? Like you, there's a lot of pawns to play in, but maybe it's too much rejection, no matter how you're taking it.
Yeah. And I mean, that's our cross to bear, and everyone has, you know, different ways of dealing with it. And it also, it ebbs and flows, right? Like sometimes you're better at it and sometimes you're not. This has been a bad year for most people. So
is that because of, this is still residual effects of the like SAG and WAG and all of, is that still percolating and causing issue?
Yeah, excuse me. So I think it's a real,
there's so much.
Yeah, it's a real confluence of factors. So, I mean, the big thing is that, and I'm sure people have heard this already, but it's the streaming wars are over and peak TV is dead. So if people don't know, just very, very quickly.
Yeah, please.
Wall Street was throwing billions of dollars at the streamers to build up their catalogs to get as many viewers and as many members as they could.
Eyeballs.
With Wall Street is really, really quick to sort of jump on new tech bandwagons. And I think an analogy that people will understand or an example is NFTs. Everyone remember NFTs?
Yeah.
People are selling NFTs for millions and millions of dollars. When's the last time you heard about NFTs? You haven't, because they're basically gone, right? It was a bit of a grift. Anyway,
well, the Bitcoin thing too, right? Like that, you're bordering on pyramid marketing, lateral selling, whatever the fuck you want to call it.
Well, and I believe, and we someone can fact check this, but I believe that China has actually outlawed cryptocurrency now.
Oh, good. Well, at least someone is.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of a Ponzi scheme. Again, I know nothing about that side of stuff, but anyway, just going back to the streamers. So Wall Street is dumping all this money into Hollywood. So there's all of these, you know, everyone's trying to build up their library to, you know, to get those dollars, right. In, I believe it was in 2022, there were 600 scripted shows. It was either 2022 or 2023, right? So think about the number of actors and crew and everything that's going to be involved in that. And then the next year after that, it was like already cut in half, right? Because Wall Street finally said, hey, where is all this money going? Are we making any money? And they cracked everyone's books and were like, oh, no one's making money. Well, we got to stop the bleeding here, right? And then, as you said, SAG-AFTRA strike, WGA strikes, very necessary. I wasn't a part of SAG-AFTRA when that's happening. I'm a member now. But of course, it affects us. I was in Vancouver when the writer's strike in like 2007 or 2008 hit.
Rising tide raises all ships, good or bad.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that. Then, of course, we had, you know, the terrible fires in LA. There's, you know, geopolitical tensions that, of course, everyone's familiar with. We've got the trade war now between the US and Canada and other countries. So it's literally a perfect storm for, you know, the industry to just be moving down. So
art is the first thing they cut, right? Art,
yeah.
Sadly, but truthfully, they cut it in school, they cut it in life. Like, you know, give them cake, right? Unless the cake's too expensive.
Yeah, and isn't it funny that, you know, if I hate referencing the pandemic just because, you know, it's still so fresh and was so many of us, but yeah, right. Look at what is the first thing that everyone did, right? You run to consume art. It was music, it was shows, it was, do you know what I mean? Like anyone that tells me that art isn't valuable, that kids don't need to learn this stuff, I just want to tell them, okay, go home, throw all your books out, take all your art off the wall. Don't listen to music when you're driving in your car. You can't go to concerts. You can't go to movies. You can't go to theater. Throw your TV away. Don't read poetry. Don't read prose. Like,
no, dude, I get it. Like,
what are we even doing?
Well, did you see that quote from Ethan Hawke about, we don't need it in the good times. We need it when the shit hits the fan. And you're totally right. The proof is in the pandemic. We all ran to it. We were like, give me more fucking Tiger King, right? Like it was anything to take you away from the fact that you weren't allowed outside. You weren't allowed to socialize. And if you did, you had to hide in the back of your friend's trunk to get into their house because their neighbors might rat on you. Right. Like it was pandemonium in a pandemic. So yeah, no, you're 100% right. These are the things that soothe us, that make us forget the bullshit. Not like I have the 9 to 5. I rely on you as an entertainer to take me out of my 9 to 5 cubicle, bad, shitty lighting environment to make me remember what inspires me, what moves me.
Well, and I would also say that, like, I'm not a creator. Do you know what I mean? Like, we can get into a whole discussion about whether actors are artists. And I think that, like, there are some actors that are artists. I mean, I would love to get the opportunity to work towards that, but ultimately
that starts, sorry to cut you off, but where do you think it stops being a job and you transcend to artistry? Is it a performance? Is it the collaborative effort, the people you're working with, the budget? Like, where do you?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't necessarily think there's one answer. I think it's just that. So basically for anything I've been allowed to do thus far has been in a supporting or lower capacity. Right.
Yeah,
sure. So my job generally is to just come in and make everyone else look good. Now that should always be every actor's job.
Yeah.
But like we can talk,
right? Yes. Right. Keep everybody.
But someone like, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman or, you know, Francis McDormand or Denzel, like these are artists, Johnny Depp, Christian Bale, you know, these are artists. It's if you're asked to transform, it's those real sort of transformative performances that maybe that's sort of what I would categorize.
Austin Butler and Elvis, and you can't drop the thank you very much for 2 years.
Yeah. All of that. I mean, you know, De Niro for Raging Bull or whatever. Right. So
Lewis, right.
I don't know. This is, there's probably people right now who study like the theory of art and are absolutely just cringing because we're talking around something that they're like, oh my God, that's, you know, that's not to take away from it. Like, I think that I think people should, and especially young actors, they should approach acting as a craft. You're not special if you like acting. You're only special because there's no one else in your small town that likes it.
Yeah.
But you're part of a larger community and we're all interested in it. You know what I mean? So study it like you would a craft. Like, you know, younger actors will contact me sometimes and be like, oh, like, what would you recommend that I do? And I'm like, well, get better. Like, what do you mean? If there was a secret, someone would have bottled it and would be selling it. And I would have subscribed to that already. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just study. Like, and the analogy I always use is like, listen, if you want to become a welder, how do you become a good welder? Well, you weld.
Yeah. It's painful that it's that simple, but it's in the 10,000 hours of welding.
Yes, correct. And the unfortunate thing is that for us, you know, that haven't been fortunate enough to book those like long running recurring roles or to be on, my God, the original Heat, I don't know if you've ever looked into this, shot for like 189 days.
Yeah, it's insane.
That doesn't happen anymore. No. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, but to have that, to your Wall Street point, it's because now the stockbrokers and the CEOs who are strapped by the investors are going, give me more Henry Cavill, bring him back, even though it's an end credit scene. It doesn't matter, right? Like, it's these stupid, asinine decisions because the movie makers are not making them anymore. The books are making them.
Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting that I swear all the studios would have to do, and this is so far, you know, above me in terms of the pay grade, but if I was, you know, on the board of Disney, I would fire, is it Zaslav? Anyway, or is he
not? Zaslav the Warners, but I get your point.
You know, get rid of him and I would bring on a filmmaker. Like, don't you want?
Well, that's what he did. I don't, now they need to replace, James Gunn needs to replace Zaslav with someone else because now you've got, like, the Warner Brothers were filmmakers. They were entertainers. They liked to make things and put them on big screens and watch people glow. And now you've got the 30% shareholder of Warner Brothers going, Zaslav, no.
Yeah. Well, what the main issue is, and you may have heard this, right, is that it's that these businesses are now vertically integrated, where production, distribution, and like the cinema houses were all separate businesses, right?
Yeah.
So the studio had to sell the movie to a distributor that was then going to sell it to the movie houses. Now you've got, you know, Netflix is one thing, Disney is one thing. So they don't have to make a good product because they have no one to sell it to but you, the end user, right? Luckily, I think Disney and Marvel realized sort of in this last phase that didn't do so well, you know, with their sort of TV offerings, that now they're kind of pumping the brakes, and they've even stated out that they're going to go more for quality over quantity.
I think it's been like two shows a year max, and then back to four, where I think it was like 4 to 5 movies a year and 3 to 6 TV shows. Like, cause they would do, and like those, I'm sorry to just break stride, but like those stupid end credits on those shows are like half the show.
Right.
Like it was to anybody who watched any Disney content for streaming shows, it was absolutely annihilating because you're like, wait, this show's only 19 minutes long now. Like, what are you doing? Right. You've got all this money. What are you doing? Anyways. That's your point.
That's just, I think,
vertically integrated control of everything.
Yes. Yeah, so it, I mean, listen, I would, if the studios want to save the film business, I think you need to have filmmakers in charge. You know, it's, I think that's really the only way forward. I mean, look at the success of Blumhouse and then A24, which looks like they sort of taken a page out of the Blumhouse model.
Yeah.
You can make money on a $10 million film. You don't need to have a $500 million, you know, budget, and then you need to make 1.2 globally, right? It's just, there's too much out there. I hope that they start making more, you know, 10, 20, $30 million films and
take the 100 million and make 10 smart, genre heavy, like really interesting, questionable, thought provoking movies that make people talk, and then go to the water cooler Monday instead of, well, I'll just wait until the clips roll for the Marvel movie and then I don't even have to go anymore because someone will tell me by Monday that what the end credit is. Like, the identity of the movie theater is lost with this new home theater bullshit, because it will never truly, through the last 120 years, the entire industry has gone through the ebb and flow, the up and down, right? Like, I mean, in the 30s, they had to tell people to come back to the theaters, they were safe. And in the 50s and the 60s, there's always these trials and tribulations. They usually follow a strike, surprisingly. And, you know, it will never die, but the theater experience has to be, everybody has to be reminded about why laughing with 100 strangers is better than just you and your kids.
Yeah. And luckily it looks like the Naked Gun, the new Naked Gun is doing really, really well. And so they are sort of saying that, oh man, maybe comedy is back.
Comedy's safe because it's all about being canceled. It's all about being offensive. Yeah. And the thing about the Naked Gun that is reminded everybody is that for a while there was so much comedy. And then for a minute it was like, you just like it totally got blindsided by the offensive line like Tropic Thunder, right? Tropic Thunder is a prime example of what people love to use as, oh, that's offensive. And it's like, if you go and clip roll the hell out of that, you will find that everybody finds it funny. And the joke is in the fact that another white guy has stolen the job of a black guy. That's where the joke lies. It's not in making fun of somebody, but it's like our intelligence has been dumbed down because of, you know, all the shit that goes on in the world.
And
you,
yeah, and I think it's just, you know, there have been some terrible, you know, there's terrible people and there's terrible productions where they feel that comedy is punching down. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, that's just not how comedy works, no. Right? It needs to either be self-deprecating or you have to be punching up, right? So anyway.
All ones do that. But yeah, all of this really lays an interesting groundwork for my question now, because I know you're classically trained in the theater as a young kid, right? Grew up yes. in theater. Parents were super supportive of the career choice.
Yeah, surprisingly. I mean,
when did you start? Like, because there's a lot of you have a cinephile heart to me. You have a passion for how the industry operates and how it moves and more than just your part in it. Like you love the entire aspect of it. So,
I do.
Did give that to you?
Sorry, say again. You just cut out there.
Did you learn that in theater, like the love of performing, or when did it really start to hit for you in your theater days?
Yeah, it's just it's just something that I always did. I mean, as you said, my parents and they're both still alive. They're healthy. They're with us. My mom and dad and
hey mom, hey dad.
Yeah, hey guys. They're gonna listen to this later. But yeah, they were always. Their goal was that they wanted to be able to send my brother and I to university and do whatever we wanted to do and graduate without debt, because they both had to sort of, you know, take on and shoulder a bit of debt. So what an amazing goal. And, you know, I'm so honored and privileged to have, you know, received that. So, I mean, imagine then coming and saying like, I want to study drama. And never mind, I started as a philosophy major.
Oh boy.
I did 2 years of a philosophy major just because I loved writing essays. That's really the only thing I really like. I loved drama in school and I loved writing essays. So I was good in English and I was good in theater and everything else was kind of middling. But my parents took me to a lot of theater, you know, when I was growing up. Edmonton is a very prolific theater town. I don't know if people know that. If you're not from there, people would probably think that's
a big deal.
Well, and the Edmonton Fringe Fest is the second oldest and it's the second largest in the world, like behind Edinburgh.
That's insane. I did not
people
know.
Have no idea how big it is, right? And so I grew up in, like, I was doing, you know, theater in high school is where I started sort of seriously sort of looking into it. And I studied with Stage Polaris, which doesn't exist anymore. And doing, like, you know, high school drama competitions and stuff like that.
I was in them. I know what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Awesome. So it was really cool because
I danced, I acted, I sang, I did performing arts, I was in jazz band. Like, I have a performer's soul. When you give me a
mic. Oh, amazing. Okay, amazing. Well, that's really cool. Listen, you should come back, man. You got such a great look.
Oh, shush.
I mean, listen, we'll talk later.
How we get, for sure.
But listen, what was it? So how did you get into it?
My mother wanted me out of trouble. So, and I mean, I've always been like, I've gravitated towards, the center of attention. I'm an only child. So I was fawned over. I got everything at Christmas. So I think I learned at a young age how to control the room, because I just figured it out. Like, if I react this way to this present, if I act this happy, then I get, like, it's kind of a mischievous way of figuring out that you like performing, because you're like, I know how to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, and what you were learning is that relationship, yes. Right? And that exchange and that emotional currency, right? Which 100%. Is literally the bedrock for that type of work. That's really interesting. I'm the youngest. I have an older brother, but I was like painfully shy. Right. I am not interested in being like, I am not extroverted. Sidebar, if anyone is out there and is interested in acting, you do not need to be an extrovert to do this job. You really don't. I am not interested in doing improv. I don't want to go and do stand-up comedy. You know, I don't, that's not what I'm interested in. But, you know, And being on stage is very different than being on screen. Being on stage, as you know, it's like, I'm here and I'm taking a space and everyone look at me. On a film set, no one's watching you. You could be on set and there could be 300 people. They don't care. They're not watching you, right? Even the guy, like even the camera ops, like he's got his own thing to worry. He doesn't care about you.
Job.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. Which is actually the absolute most freeing. You think everyone's watching you, but really nobody's watching you. I don't mean that in a bad way. They have their own shit to do, right?
That's really interesting because the layman's perspective, the fan's perspective is that everyone all of a sudden stops and it's like, all right, action. And it's like, no, they're just stopping moving so that the sound guy doesn't lose his fucking shit.
100%. You just have to be quiet to get clean sound. That's it. And that's all, right? And if you know that as an actor, then you're just free from it, right? Because then you know that the only person that you need to worry about is your scene partner and or partners, or your fight partner and or partners, right? And
yeah, that's really interesting because like I've been on a couple sets. Like I day job is United Rentals. If you see a boom show up on set in Winnipeg, I'm the Michael at United Rentals that everybody.
Yeah, I know. I listened to 291 and you guys were saying that nobody just took like all of the, nobody too took all the booms you were
at
saying.
Guys at Lilac, it was insane. That was the worst week of my summer last year. And
Right.
Mastiolones, the production assistant on, or production manager on that one, is like one of my favorites. I love all the production managers in town, but Brandon really made it easy to do that stuff. Cause like, we didn't even know you had a second unit. Like,
I remember you saying that in the episode and you're like, why didn't you guys tell me here was a second unit?
Like if I known, like my pace is based on your pace. So like if I hear haste in their voice and I know that we're moving at things are not going smoothly. And if I hear it's a very lazy Sunday afternoon type persona, then I'm like, okay, we've got a minute here. Right. Like I know how to kind of read the room, but mm-hmm. that week was insane. And then after he's like, oh yeah, we had a second unit the whole shoot. I'm like, you're hilarious.
Yeah.
Next time, tell your vendor. But yeah, no, it was I lost my train of thought.
Where were we? I mean, we were talking about your performing background.
Yeah. So the difference between being on set and there being very little people, so you have a lot of freedom to do that. And I mean, yeah, if you make a mistake in film, I mean, yes, it's expensive, but let's do it again.
And
there's no place to run.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's also, I think, really important, you know, for young actors to remember that like the editor is just hunting for a moment, right? So even if you're shooting a scene that's on you for like 4 minutes, they're not going to use the whole scene. So if you mess up the last two lines, they've got a thousand other things that they can cut to, right?
And 18 takes of it. So if you've flubbed it there, but they want to keep it here, they've got it. It's
yeah, this is it. And this is, I think it's really important for theater performers. This took me a long time to learn. You don't want to commit what we call the crime of consistency, right? This is from, his name is eluding me right now. It's called Secrets of Screen Acting, Patrick Tucker.
There we go.
Secrets of Screen Acting by Patrick Tucker. If people haven't read this book, I think it's like $80 on Amazon because it's out of print. Get it. It changed my life.
I got a question for you, actually.
What's that, sorry?
Sorry to cut you off. I got a question for you. I heard Tom Cruise say that as an actor, know the lens, know the text, know the lighting. Does having an idea of everyone else's job and situation, not an in-depth one, but just something to understand about how to pull focus and working with all those facets, is that something that actors of today should start thinking about? Because it really isn't something that I, as a fan and as someone who reads this stuff, you never hear people say that. It's like, here's my job, that's your job, I just need to get it in the can. But having respect and perspective might help.
I mean, listen, everything that Tom Cruise says about filmmaking is correct.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I watch Tom Cruise in movies that I don't even like, and I like him.
Me too.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That guy has been hitting not only home runs, grand slams for 40 years. Do you know what I mean? He's incredible. Now, yes, So do you need to know, you know, why the cinematographer is setting those lights? No. But you know, if there's a sliver of light that you need to hit because that's your pin light on your eye, well, you need to know that because you have to hit that every time or there's no shot, right? And then in terms of lenses, you don't need to listen, you know, is it a 35, is it a 50, is it a 75? I mean, that would be helpful because then you know sort of what your frame is, right? The fastest trick is to just look where the boom is, right? If the boom is here, you know it's a close-up. If the boom is here, you know it's a medium. If you can't see the boom, you know it's a wide. So all that to say, Michael, that, you know, if it's a wide shot, I have to act with my whole body. If it's a medium, I'm head and shoulders. If it's a close-up, it's just my face. And if it's an extreme close-up, it's probably just my eyes and the muscles around my eyes. And those are all different types of acting. There's a great scene in the first Knives Out where Daniel Craig is way at the top of the mansion.
Yep.
And he's telling them to go get somebody.
Yeah.
And you see him, he's like bending his knees and doing this because he's 200 feet away. But you couldn't do that in a close-up because you'd look like Jim Carrey in, you know, in Pet Detective. Do you know what I mean? No, that works for a whole other reason, right? But yes, I didn't know. So when I left theater school, so I spent like most of my teens studying acting and then, you know, most of my 20s. So by the time I left theater school, I had been immersed, you know, in theater, you know, 12 hours a day for 6.5 years. It was a long time. So when I moved, I graduated, I did some theater before I left Edmonton. I moved to Vancouver. That was sort of always the goal. But I had just spent all of this time studying acting. I thought I don't need to take any more classes. And so if I could go back in time, I would have said to, you know, younger me, get into a film class because you know how to act, but you don't know how to act in this medium. And so it took
my point is to understand the artistic side of it. You have to understand how the medium, like the how they make the sausage, as cliche.
Yeah, 100%. And so you'll hear, I hate this discussion that you hear online where they're like, oh, auditions like self-tapes are a completely different thing from acting. No, self-tapes are a medium.
Yeah.
That's it. It's learning to act in that medium close. That's it. That's all it is, right? And so how do you, you know, if you have a lot of movement and stuff, how does that translate into that size of shot? But it's not different. How could it be different? That doesn't make any sense to me. That just sounds like
doesn't make
people
sense.
That are upset about never being cast. And they're like, oh, it's a completely different art form. No, it's not. No, it's not. You just don't know how to use the frame properly.
Yeah. And I mean,
I'm still learning it as well. Do you know what I mean? Just going back to the pandemic, again, I hate to reference this, but honestly, the pandemic was the greatest thing for my career because all of a sudden now we're forced to watch self-tapes. And so I learned really quick. I was like, oh no, like what I'm doing isn't working. And everything I booked up until that point, I swear to God, is just sheer dumb luck.
It's giving you a moment to self-critique. And be honest with yourself about what you're doing. And because, yeah, like I've noticed that too. When I cut clips of the show, I'm like, oh, I have to look at myself. And like, I'm not used to looking at myself. So the first part of wanting to share this crap was, okay, I guess I have to film the show, first of all, if I'm going to play in this game. And then I'm like, okay, now I have to be okay with how I look on camera. Then I started realizing, okay, what angles are good, what angles are bad. Then I started to realize what lighting in this room works. And I'm not saying it's on right now, but when it's on and we're recording, I have a better understanding of wide and two shot and one shot just from looking at myself and then wondering, what does it look like if I cut to two of us in a shot or three of us in a shot? And
Amazing.
It makes me want to edit shit now. And I
know. Well, I was going to say that's literally filmmaking. Yeah. Like you are literally a filmmaker. If you're thinking about angles, you're thinking about lighting, you're thinking about what the audience sees.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm like, does this look like shit? Is my nose hair out? What does Jimmy look like from this angle? That person's gut is hanging out. That can't happen. Like all of those things start to come into play. And I'm like, it took the 10,000 hours to get here because we've been doing this for, well, this is 8 years now. And like,
that's so awesome.
I didn't even know how to edit a clip. I didn't know you could take the end of a thing and put it at the beginning and take the beginning and put it in the middle and take the middle and get rid of it. Like that to me just didn't work. And then one day it made sense. And I was like, oh, this is what Tom Cruise is talking about. It isn't what I do. It's not, I know audio. I know how to make something sound good after, but video was something I didn't know. But understanding it and doing it, and even in the basics that I do it in, which is dumb, silly clips of the things we love, it still is editing and putting together and piecing in a somewhat of a narrative.
Yeah, that's amazing. And 8 years, I mean, my God, what that's an accomplishment. That's amazing. But what you found, Michael, and sort of I think what I found as well is sort of what I would say to any actor that's starting out is that you need to watch yourself to the point where you can actually objectively watch your performance. And that might be 100 self-tapes. And at the rate that they're coming in now, that might take a couple of years. You know what I mean? If you're waiting for them, obviously you can do them on your own and, you know, kind of fast track that, right? But yeah, the young actors that I teach, you know, especially new ones, will be like, "Oh, you know, I hate my voice. Oh, I don't. I hate." It's like, okay, but get over that,
Yeah,
because,
figure it out.
yeah, you know what I mean. So that's also why I never ask actors how they feel in my classes, because I don't care. It doesn't matter. You know what I mean? So in my class, first of all, any actors that are going to listen to this podcast, if you are in an on-camera acting class and you don't watch your performance back on a monitor, you are in a theater acting class.
Sure.
If the whole class watches your performance standing in your, that's a little black box theater and you're doing theater. You need to watch that monitor back. So in my classes, we'll shoot a scene, and the way that I set up my class as well, as a theater performer, if you put me into a little black box, I'm going to switch into theater mode and I'm going to start pushing to the back of that. I'm not going to be playing to where the boom
Getting
is.
to getting the grandma in the
Right?
back seat. Yeah, totally.
So classes are usually set up to foster the teacher, and that's not fair. It should be set up to foster the students. So when I'm teaching my classes, my students are sitting here, the TV is here, and then I've got my backdrop separating the actor, and the actor doing the scene is in the front. And we're filming this way, so they can't see each other. And so if there are theater trained actors, they won't flip.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a little harder for me because I'm running back and giving notes and stuff, but it's not about my comfort. I shouldn't be able to sit in the back and just the stupid acting teacher thing, right?
Paul Gross and Slings and Arrows.
Well, yeah, great reference. Yeah, what a great series.
I love that, man. Men with Brooms is one of my favorite comedies of all time.
Dude, if we can go on a Men with Brooms tangent for a second.
All
So I
right.
believe that hit the theaters in 1999.
I was a late bloomer in the 90s.
When you study theater history, and we touch on theater history a little bit, you know, in the BFA program that I did, the Ecstasy of Rita Joe, which was performed out in BC, that they sort of that is the catalyst for when the theater companies in Canada started producing Canadian-made work. Up until that point, all of the theater, there were like major American touring companies that were coming into Canada, but there weren't really like local, you know, theater companies producing local theater. That was when things changed, right? I thought that when I went to see Men with Brooms in theater, that that was going to be the catalyst. Like, here I am, a young actor, you know, just as you know, not even in the BFA program yet, still just kind of trying to figure this thing out. Going to you know, a cinema in Canada, watching a Canadian-made production with Canadian actors, I was like, oh, this is it.
I can do this.
This is the Ecstasy of Rita Joe for first for Canadian film. It wasn't, as we know. But man, like,
No, but for you, it gave you a little bit of a pep in your step, right? It was when people say, I see myself on screen, I can be a Canadian actor doing a Canadian story on a
yeah.
Canadian network in a Canadian theater, right? Like it shrinks the bubble.
Yeah, I hope that people recognize that. I mean, the Americans, their number one export is culture, right? And we are right, you know, we are right at the end of the barrel. We get the brunt of it, right? Think about countries like in Europe or in South America, right? They desperately have to produce their own culture and their own content, or they're just going to be you know, they're going to become nothing, right? Look at New Zealand. What's the population of New Zealand? And their film and TV industry is so strong. We're in this weird sort of cultural, you know, melange, because you know, we're influenced. Our theater scene is influenced from England. Our film and TV scene is heavily influenced from the United States, but we don't really have a cultural identity when it comes to it.
Well, we do, but it's like raccoons or Fred Penner or like it's
Well,
things made by us for smaller genre based groups. Like, I mean, when they try to do it, like Suits Canada, right? When they shot in Toronto, I don't think like did that show take off? Because
I think they're going into their third season. Oh, no, sorry. You're talking about Law & Order Toronto.
Law & Order Toronto. That's it. Not
third season, I think.
Toronto, but Law & Order, yeah. So, okay, that's great because that's what usually gets in the way. It's always it's always Big Brother Canada, right? You hear this Canada at the end of it, and then it automatically might discount it because people who don't know that it's licensing more than it's, you know, this or that. But there is that sad discounted version. And it's like, instead of trying to do what someone else is doing, put all of that money into something that's Canadian, that backs the culture, that,
yeah,
like that is a longer than, you know, little 5-minute vignette on CTV at 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah. So there are a lot of issues that sort of at play here. The major issue, Michael, from my perspective, and there are much smarter people in the industry that are actually sort of working at the forefront of this, it's that all of our funding is government funding.
Yeah.
Right. We have no private funding institutions, right? So it's all Telefilm and Canada Film Board now and CBC. Now, these are great institutions and they do great work. But at the end of the day, someone that has a great idea for a commercially viable film should be able to make funds. And my understanding is that doesn't necessarily always happen. If you've heard of, there's a Canadian streaming service called highball.tv.
Okay.
And it was started by two writer, director, performers in Toronto, Melissa D'Agostino and Matt Campagna. And they are literally fighting this fight. They are producing Canadian work. They are distributing Canadian work, and they post about this all the time, how they're just fighting and fighting and fighting to get funding. Anyway, all that to say, if you are Canadian and you are in Canada and you want us to survive culturally and to have a voice, you have to support the narratives that are coming out here. You have to. I hope everyone went to see 40 Acres, R.T. Thorne's movie that came out. Daniel Deadweiler was starring in it. Like, that was, we shot that up in Sudbury. Okay. It's, you know, Glenn Taylor, the writer, these are all, it was all Canadians. You know, it's an incredibly important story.
What is the story? I am sadly ignorant to it. So
that's okay. It's on streaming right now. I think you can get it on, I think, Prime in the States and maybe Crave here. Anyway, right. It's number 12 on Rotten Tomatoes 100 list of top action movies of 2025 so far. It's a family, a mixed family, African Canadian and Indigenous family, surviving in this post-apocalyptic world, and they've carved out this little niche where they're surviving, and then they get attacked by these cannibals, and it's sort of like how the family survives.
I'll watch that as soon as we're done. That's right, dystopian.
Dude, it's awesome. Yeah, dystopian. Yeah, sci-fi. Yeah, it's awesome. But
Canadian Road per se.
Yeah, great. And also, what a great movie, what a great book, Cormac McCarthy. Yes.
Cormac McCarthy forever.
But yeah, so I would encourage everyone to go and watch 40 Acres. I would encourage everyone to go check out highball.tv. Now,
they have an app or are they web based? Like, would I?
No, there'd be an app, but I think it's also, yeah, you can just, however, you just watch Netflix and Prime, it's the same. Okay. Now, we are here having this conversation, Michael, because of my work in an American production. And so I don't want to sit here, you know, I don't want it to sound like I'm bashing America, but we have to have our own, you know, culture and our own art as well. But I'm very thankful. Most of the work that I have done and that I am doing is in American productions. Canada is a service industry, you know, for the American film industry. That's just the reality of it, right?
Anybody who's listening that doesn't know what Manitoba offers, it is one hell of an aggressive tax credit to bring the industry here. But what that really does is it ends up making really great shit, because the talent in Manitoba and the industry style in Manitoba is not like you would probably, because you lived in Vancouver and Toronto, you know, those are big metropolitan industries.
Yeah.
We're a little bit more cottage, but that serves to what you can produce here. And the list of things that have been made here, but you're right. Yeah. We are servicing the American story. We are not servicing the Canadian story.
Yeah. Which, I mean, again, that's a whole other conversation, you know, about that.
But work is work though, right? Like
listen, yeah, work is work. I'm just happy to work. I'm happy to be of service. You know, I hope I'm seen as valuable. That's always my goal. Yeah, I don't know if people realize this. So Manitoba has the strongest tax credit in the entire country. I am going to send a letter to Wob Kanu. Sidebar, I love Wob. I think he's doing a great job.
Shut up.
I think that our tax credit needs to be increased. I remember seeing a study from years ago. This was around the time that Saskatchewan foolishly completely tanked their tax credit. Their revenues are down like billions of dollars because of it. They did a study. I believe this was in Canada. Someone can see if they can find this study, but it was like literally for every dollar that a government puts into the film industry, they get $7 back. Because what people don't think about
don't
when
get
you
those bring, odds anywhere else.
Yeah, right. When you bring, like when Bob Odenkirk and Sharon Stone, you know, and Timo Tijanto come into town here, they have to put them up at hotels. They're taking taxis and Ubers. They're eating at restaurants. Like they are literally dumping buckets of cash into our local economy. Never mind hiring all the local people that are here. And I'm not just talking about me. I'm talking about like, we're talking about hair. We're talking about makeup. We're talking about our world-class crews that are here that literally work for 11 and a half months of the year straight because there's so much filming here, right?
Okay. It's like, and I mean, I've been doing my job for 12 years. And I mean, I remember the first day I got a phone call from someone in a movie asking for a boom. I'm pretty sure I had to wipe my pants after because I was so excited.
Yeah, yeah.
That this new job that I took got phone calls from people who make all of my favorite memories in life for movies, sadly. But like, I'm kidding. But like all of the things that have moved me or taught me or whatever, if I know anything, it's from a film or a TV show. And yeah, being able to be adjacent to that as a fan, which is why I think that makes me good at my job, because I go, okay, tell me what you need. Why do you need it? I want to know what you're doing. Okay, so this, okay, let's problem solve together. Where I don't know what my competition does, but I don't think there's many of me sitting behind an equipment vendor's desk ready to go, okay, let's make this happen because I want to see your movie.
Sure. And I can only think
I am one of those people that you're talking about. I benefit as a vendor who gets rental dollars from this. So the economy, yep, business wise gets it. The mom and pop shops, the little gift shops that get mentioned, like as soon as Bob Odenkirk says, go to Wolseley, anybody who's coming here going forward is going to Wolseley.
100%.
Yeah. So that's even the things you can't even buy that are worth more than a dollar is, oh, it's word of mouth from Slippin' Jimmy.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so think about the value that you bring to somebody, because having those conversations and being a fan of film, when someone says, listen, this is why we need the boom because we're doing this shot, blah, 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 blah. You file that away. A couple of years later, you have a production manager that maybe isn't as experienced saying, oh my God, we've got this shot, blah, blah, blah. You can go, hey man, a couple of years ago, you know, on this 87 North production, they had this shot. Do you remember when they did this is the gear that they took. And then all of a sudden, boom.
Yeah, no, I've realized
you just saved the day.
Yeah, and the industry works on relationships. It's insane. Like there is a sense of loyalty that I have never seen in another customer base or another industry. When they find you, they go, all right, I'm keeping that person because I don't want to ever have to think about that again. That person knows, so I don't have to have XYZ doing this. I don't have to call again. I don't have to find this person everywhere I go. I know I have it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, 87 North, I mean, they are literally shooting their fifth production here.
And you know, I rented to the last podcast, them, David.
What's that?
I've rented to every single one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. So, I mean, to your point, it's we are obviously doing enough to keep these major American production companies here. So I hope it continues. But I hope also that when these guys do go back to L.A. or Atlanta or the other markets that they're from, that they do talk about how Winnipeg works and why it works and how well it works.
If you need it for this, just like I'm the nerd at United Rentals, Winnipeg is that place where if you need old Chicago, if you need to pour sand in the middle of the road and shoot Brad Pitt for an afternoon, you can get away with that here because it's all in the ground. You don't have to build it, right? We built it. It lasted. Now they come. You bring up a great point because, first of all, your performance in Nobody 2 made, like, your fight sequence is my favorite fight sequence, had I not been speaking to you.
I appreciate that.
It is. You, I even knew you were going to be the guy to get into the fight as soon as you were on camera. I was like, that guy is going to be the fight guy. So with everything that we've talked about, we're here to talk about Nobody Too. So first of all, how does this all start for you? Like, were you going into it for stunts originally, or were you, did you want to, how did you want to be in this movie? Was it always stunts?
No. So, I auditioned for Toby.
Okay.
Carmen Kodak, who is basically the main
Carmen, one of the best casting agents.
Yeah. Award-winning, multiple award-winning, you know, hundreds and hundreds of credits. Just, I mean, she's worked with everybody. She cast me in my first film, you know, when I was just coming out of theater school. So it was Ginger Snaps Back, the beginning.
Oh yeah.
If people haven't seen that one, it's a banger.
It is.
It was supposed to go to the theater, but when they were mastering it, the negative got scratched. And so they had to spend the entire marketing budget rebuilding that. And then, so the second one had to go to theater to make up for that loss. And then the third one went straight to DVD, but it was supposed to be the opposite. Anyway,
Snaps is such an underrated horror.
Yeah. And, Catherine Isabel and Emily Perkins are lovely human beings. Anyway. So I've known Carmen for a very long time. That's a relationship that we've been able to maintain, and she's been very good to me in giving me these opportunities. So she called me in for Toby. It was written, the way that it was written was not something that I probably should have read for. But of course, because of my stunt skill set, it was like, oh, well, this maybe could work. So there was that. There was the audition. And then Rick Skeen, who you probably know. So if people don't know, Rick Skeen is the OG stunt coordinator, stunt performer here in Manitoba. Again, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of credits.
Boys, John and
Sean and Dan. Yeah, very prolific stunt performers, coordinators in their own right. Actually, they're directing and stunt coordinating on Shoresy.
I know. I saw the clips of set. I was like, way to go, boys.
Yeah, yeah. Which, sidebar, you know, amazing Canadian, you know, TV show and Letterkenny and all this stuff.
How are you now?
Yeah, right. Anyway, Rick called me as I was leaving a table read of The Long Walk.
Okay.
And like, hey, I'm gonna put you in for this Toby role. Like, is that something you're interested in? The stunt actor role? And I was like, oh, actually, I just send in a tape. He goes, oh, okay, great. Yeah, I'll put you forward and kind of see what happens. And then so I'm hoping it was sort of a combination of the three that, you know, they saw the self tape. It's Carmen saying, yes, I've worked with this guy. And they, you know, they checked out my IMDb. And then also Rick saying, yeah, I've worked with this guy. And, you know, it's going to help, because again, it could be super dangerous, right? You know, 87 North, that they don't necessarily know who's here. Right. So you could have, you know, someone gets vouched for and then they can't do the job. It's like, so luckily it was a perfect storm. It all worked out. I hope everyone's happy with the performance. Bob, in a couple of podcasts, like he was on Conan O'Brien's podcast. He talked about the fight specifically, which is pretty cool. Sidebar: I don't ever call him Bob. I always call him Bob Odenkirk, because like, I don't know him. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was in a scene with him, and he's super cool. But like, I'm not going to be that guy.
I know.
He's Bob Odenkirk. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was awesome. So
Tristan, is he a Robert, you think, after?
Yeah, that's right. I don't know. But Tristan Carlucci, who you probably know, who's the local stunt performer as well. And then Jason Day was also in the fight. He's actually based in Vancouver. He's the one that gets the whack-a-mole in the face there. Tristan's the one that went through the claw machine,
yeah, where he beat him.
And of course Neil Adams and Joel LaBelle were on the ropes there pulling him through.
And you get hucked, right? If I remember correctly.
Say again.
You get hucked around, like you get thrown on the wall.
No, so Tristan got ratcheted just pulled like through the, like Bob pushes him, but he was on a
wire.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the coolest thing that I got to do in the movie was when my face, this is in all of the trailers and it's been out in theater, so this is not a spoiler. But Bob smashes my face into a pinball machine.
It does.
Bro, I don't think I'm ever going to get to do anything cooler than that. Like I did a BBC show years and years ago when I lived in Vancouver. We shot up in Squamish. I got to get in and out of a hovering helicopter twice.
Really?
Like, nuts.
You do the rope drop?
No rope. I had to climb physically in and out of it, just like Yeah. It was nuts. Matthew Wortman directed that. He's a great British-based director. But he even said to me when we were done the shot, he's like, "You're cooked." He goes, "You will never do anything this cool." I was like, "Oh no, you're right." So that ranks up pretty high. But the way that they shot that pinball shot, I mean, as you know, with the camera below.
Yep. Like you see, it's below, and then it's from the side, and then you spin. Like those are for the listener out there. I know a lot of that stuff is done in post, but when you're in sequence, is there any, like, are they following you? Are those camera pans, those quick turns, is that all in camera, or are we?
So the smash, we had two cameras running. There was one that was profile to me, and there was the one that was running, underneath the pane of glass. So if you see, I don't think they used the shot in the movie, but in the trailer, there's the one of me, coming up like this, but then it's mostly just the one underneath, right? So thankfully we only shot that twice. I think they only had four panes of that glass. For people that are interested, just side note, we still call it candy glass, but it's not edible anymore.
It's not made of sugar.
Yeah. So the reason, so now it's just a resin. Now the reason they did that is because when it is made with sugar, there's a slight brownish tint to the glass.
You'll see.
And
it.
So it doesn't work for modern glass.
Okay.
And so I had to switch to a resin. So it still breaks in, like you can be carrying a pane and it's just going to absolutely shatter, which is what you need when you're putting your face into it.
Sure.
I ended up cutting myself, as you always will with a glass stunt, right?
Yeah.
But the set medic came over and I was bleeding and he's like, "Oh my God, are you okay?" And he's like, he's dabbing my head. And I was like, "Bro, my adrenaline is so high right now. Like, I don't feel anything. I'm good."
So
I'm good.
Take us through the choreography of the arcade, because there's multiple people getting multiple asses kicked many different ways. How many days before are we choreographing this?
Right. So normally, when I am brought in for fight scenes, I will be part of the rehearsal process. This team is so good. Like they don't need me for those days. Why would you? You don't need to waste that money, right?
Sure. Yeah, put it on.
So Greg Rementer, who's the the supervising coordinator. I mean, if anyone wants to go on IMDb and see a ton of credits, I mean, this guy is an absolute pro. And then Kyle MacLean and Kirk Jenkins are the sort of the main fight coordinators, and then Daniel Bernhardt as well. They had this whole thing built. I mean, we're talking about guys that were doubling in Avengers. Do you know what I mean? Like these are the guys. They are absolute, top level guys, right?
Wow.
So this fight was already built when I came in. But it's only like five or six beats. You know what I mean? So it's not super complicated. Do you know what I mean?
It's not John Wick, but it is there. It's correct. A dance nonetheless.
Yeah. It's a dance, right? So, so Bob is amazing. Obviously people know this is a sequel, right? So they shot, Nobody, I believe it was 2021. I could be wrong about that, but he's been training consistently since then.
I heard this,
right?
About the heart,
like nonstop.
The
right?
Training is what like saved
lifting weights and fighting and stuff. So like he was good in Nobody. Like, I mean, you see the movie, he's great, but like he's awesome in this. Your job as a stunt performer in a fight is to elevate everyone else's performance, because actors will, there's always a varying degree of skill, physical skill, when it comes to actors, because that's not their job. Their job is emoting and telling the story and all that kind of stuff, right? They're not fighters, right? Now, luckily someone like Bob has all of those skill sets, right? So we don't have, there's no adjusting for that. It's just make sure you hit your mark because he's hitting his, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Two steps behind.
Yeah. But someone like Bob Odenkirk, I mean, I don't think the average person realizes the amount of pressure that is on someone that is the lead of a film. Because if you're in the lead of a film and it tanks, that's on you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you have a couple of those in a row, you're not going to work anymore. Do you know what I mean?
The public right. Has turned their thumb down.
Yeah, exactly. There's all that pressure, but then he's also an executive producer. He's also the main stunt performer because he's in all of the fights, right? He did some rewrites on it. Like he's wearing so many hats. Actually, if I can keep talking about that day,
Yeah,
Mike,
please.
if you don't mind, Bob had to rewrite that scene on the fly. So, no shade to Derek Kolstad and Aaron Rabin who wrote the script. But when you're writing the script, you don't know how the set is necessarily going to be built. You're going to say, interior arcade night, but you don't know the orientation of the arcade, right? The
architect doesn't understand how steel works, but
yeah, exactly, right?
So
we show up.
Yeah.
We started running the scene and the dialogue wasn't working just because of where we were in space. It didn't make sense. So Bob was like, okay, we have to, okay, what do you say now, David? Okay, so that has to be here. And then gauge what's happening. Okay, and then Paisley should be over here. And then Connie would, give her input as well and stuff. So it was this incredibly collaborative art. But then Bob literally went away. I'm assuming someone else typed this up, but literally 5 minutes later, we had new scripts in our hand. To go with, what we've done. And then he's still got to act. He's still got to fight. He's got to do all this other, kind of
That's
stuff.
Where so you get to watch Mr. Show happen, because the writer in him, the SNL guy, the guy who wrote in 30 Rock is trained to be like, well, this is Lauren. This is my Lauren impression. Well, I don't like that. That's a really bad impression.
Yeah.
But the point is that you gotta pivot.
Yeah. So, I mean, this sums up Bob's career pretty well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So he spends 25 years making his living as a comedy writer. So you already mentioned Mr. Show. You already mentioned SNL. He wrote for the Ben Stiller Show. Like, and if you read this book, like this guy has been doing sketch comedy for his entire life, right? So to have someone like that, yeah. So, I mean, I remember him from Mr. Show, right? But then, of course, Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul. So Michael, you may have experienced this, but and I'm sure that most people that you talk to would lie about this, but because I'm such a cinephile, like I get starstruck, man.
Right? No, dude, there's out of everybody I talk to, not naming names, some people say they don't, some people say it never goes away, but be professional, right? Like you can be starstruck, but also know your role, right?
So this is it. Like if you watched me from the outside, you probably wouldn't notice, but 10-year-old David inside is doing absolute backflips, right?
Fuck, because you're not. That's the thing. It's if you're really not, if you're not a fan of who you're in a scene with, you're really in the wrong industry, because everybody's a fan of everybody. Being such a nerd for cinema, it helps elevate everything in what's going on. So I think
100%
tandem, you don't get to where you get to with your career, with who you're working with. Like that's just dry toast and that's not fun.
Yeah. I like that. But yeah, I mean, also with Timo Tijanto, and apologies to anyone that speaks Indonesian. I know that pronunciation is not correct.
Notice why I haven't tried to say it yet.
Yes. but I mean, his trajectory is really, really interesting, right? So Bob has sort of said in interviews that it was one of his earlier films, which is The Night Comes for Us. But he's got a couple of like major action bangers on Netflix. It's there's Shadow Strays and The Big Four, like crazy, crazy action heavy stuff. I'm really interested to see what he's going to do next. So I don't know if you know this, Michael, he's directing The Beekeeper too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so he gets to go off and work with. They may actually be in pre-production. I sent my materials off to the stunt coordinator, but they're filming in the UK, and I don't have a visa. So, I mean, it's always a long shot anyway. It's not only the visa why I'm not going to be.
Gosh, I get your point.
Yeah, I feel that Timo's trajectory may be very similar to what we saw with Taika.
Sure. Okay.
With Taika Waititi.
With stuff like, what was it? Hunt for the Wilder People really put him on the map.
Yeah. So Boy is, if people haven't seen Boy, it's a really sort of interesting precursor to Jojo Rabbit.
Okay.
Thematically. It's sort of like his story. He plays his father in it. It's awesome. I love that movie. But a small market coming from New Zealand, telling these amazing, amazing stories. And then Hollywood snaps him up and he's doing something else right now. They're in pre-production for something. I just saw it.
Yeah. Well, I know he's trying to make Akira, and that keeps kind of popping up and then dropping and then popping up. And
yeah, that, you know what? As long as they, man, that's going to be tough. I mean, that would be like doing like any like Vampire Hunter D, or like, it's just these classic animes you'd have to be so, so careful with, just because they,
oh, you'd alienate a base real quick if you didn't do it proper.
Yeah. Like, I mean, like what unfortunately happened with Ghost in the Shell, right? Like that thing is not very well received. No shade on Scarlett Johansson. She's in one of my favorite movies of all time.
Sure.
Jojo Rabbit. Anyway, Timo's amazing. He has the most amazing, what I've noticed, the top directors that I've, you know, luckily been on set with. So Timo Taranto, Roland Joffe, Oscar nominated director, Francis Lawrence. These guys, like, they are unflappable, right? Because you're just, you know, you've worked in the industry. It is just a constant shitstorm.
It is. It's
literally just putting out fires hour after hour after hour.
And hurry up and wait. That's the two things. Like, put out the fire and then wait. Put out the fire and then wait. And then 4 seconds. All right, move on. Next fire, next problem.
Yeah. And it's, I know it doesn't seem like a miracle that anything gets made, but honestly, if people were on set and saw the issues that go down on a day-to-day basis, even just from like silly things, like I was just going for a walk with my wife. It started raining immediately. We had to run back inside. That happens all the time, you know? But
you now have to reconfigure 50 to 100 people and do this somewhere else while still having daylight. Like it's like in the Brad Pitt, that's one of my favorite movies, the one about Hollywood, Babylon.
Oh yes. I have to admit, I haven't seen Babylon. You're probably the same. I have such a crazy long list of things that I need to see. Oh. I was so happy. I finally, this is embarrassing to say, but like I finally saw Chinatown and Casablanca. Like,
we play this game where everybody's like, so like I, as someone who started this thing, I've always been a fan of movies, but as soon as you make a movie podcast, unlike a true crime or, you know, a narrative or anything else, but a movie podcast, everyone's like, you haven't seen it. And I'm like, there's no prereq for me watching everything to do this. Like I started doing this because I love talking about it all. So if I haven't seen it, let's talk about it. Why should I see it? What's so good about it? Right. That doesn't mean we can't talk about it. I have seen one Toy Story. Right. So don't feel bad about Chinatown. As much as everyone says that is the quintessential movie to watch about the era of Hollywood in the 60s and the 70s. And yeah, I mean, we can get all cinephilic about it, but at the same time, there's so much good shit that it's impossible to see everything. So
yeah, it really is. It really is now. Yeah.
Doug, makeup artist, Doug Morrow, Character Illusions. I had never seen, oh dear Lord. Been a day. I had never seen Citizen Kane. Never seen it. Never seen the world's greatest movie. Never seen the movie that changed how narrative is told and how you can do things with camera tricks. Like I'd never seen it. I didn't know the magic of Orson Welles. And as soon as he criticized me for that, I was like, okay, I should probably see that movie. And at that point, I was like, there's a whole level of cinema that no one will ever get to see. I would love to be the guy to watch everything, but yeah, it still makes you curious. Can't see it all.
No, we'll do our best. We'll try. I'm just trying to work through everything. Yeah.
What do you think of Chinatown? It's about water.
I mean, there's something really interesting about the speed of the, I'm going to make this really clear so people understand if they're not watching, right? So in modern films, I believe they've said like in, like there's a cut every sort of like 2.5 seconds, right?
Keep the eye
sometimes busy. More, sometimes less, whatever, but it's a pretty frenetic pace. But then of course, as you know, as you sort of move back in time, two things happen. You've got longer cuts and you've got wider shots, right? So they've been pushing into close-ups forever.
Yeah,
right?
And I mean, the close-up is the quintessential shot, right? Pull in where it's sexy, it's big. Yeah. It's just you. No one else is there to take it from you. But those wide, long shots create tension. They give
space. Yeah, no, 100%. But this is sort of where, I mean, they always talk about how on the waterfront sort of changed American performing as well, right? Brando is sort of cited as there is pre-Brando and there is post-Brando, right? But a lot of that also has to do with how far the camera is away from you, right? If this is your shot, this is your stage, right? everyone, as you know, that was, you know, sort of in the studio system, it was signed on to Warner Brothers or what have you.
Yeah.
They all came out of theater. And so cameras were put back where an audience would be. So if you're watching these old movies, that's why there are all of these seem like crazy, crazy wide shots, right? So in something like Chinatown or in something like a really good example, I think, for pacing would be Deer Hunter. Where that movie could not be made now. And also, I just don't think it doesn't, it wouldn't, as you said, it wouldn't have the same weight or tension because, I mean, those scenes just, you can feel it, right?
Oh, whereas God. That's been, like, sort of absolved opening, you. Opening, just the driving, you're just, it starts there, as simple as a drunken night at a wedding to a deer hunt the following day. And then just juxtapositions to Vietnam, it just beats the living shit out of you.
Yeah. So I hope, you know, everyone that's listening, I think the takeaway here is not that you need to go and watch old movies, nor do you need to like movies that are on lists, right? You always see like, oh, top 100, top 20. I saw that Parasite is sort of considered like the top movie of, which 100% totally agree with that. But that being said, like, if you don't like the aesthetic of those movies from the 60s and 70s, you're not a bad person.
No. It doesn't mean you're bad.
You can watch whatever you want. If you love the Fast and the Furious, watch it, because literally thousands and thousands of people put their blood, sweat, and tears into that. Do you know what I mean? Because this is cool for me, Michael, because I like movies, but I don't know as much as you do about it. But I'm so, like, I love talking to people that know more about it, because then I can go, oh, right, I forgot I have to watch this and oh, that director and stuff. So this is really fascinating for me, but I don't want to alienate people, you know?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And I mean, if you like, I always heard that Seven Samurai is Star Wars, right? You hear that and you go, okay, all right, well, all right, let's go see some Kira Kurosawa and see what's up. I just watched it like 6 months ago for the first time, and it took me 4 days because no one told me it was 3 hours, but, like, you know, I got a life and shit. But what I'm saying is that as soon as I saw that, I went, oh, okay. So now it's not that you have to see everything. It's just you maybe make a point to see how things changed and when things changed. And is my opinion, like, if you like a thing and someone's like, oh, it's in Seven Samurai. And as soon as I watched it, I went, oh my God, there's Chewie. There's Han. There's 3PO. There's the whole three act. There's the whole plot. There's Darth Vader, right? Like, it all comes together. And as much as they say, like, you know, like, copying is the, you know, biggest form of flattery, right? And stealing and seeing where everything kind of came from. As long as you have a respect for where it all came from, you don't need to see it all to respect it.
Sidebar: have you heard the rest of that quote? So imitation is the sincerest form of flattery that mediocre can give to greatness. That's the actual quote.
Wow. I love how they left the back half out.
Right? Yeah. So it's a real barb. Yeah. So I think for filmmakers, it's much more important to understand the history, because, you know, you may be doing something that you think you're creating and it's from Kurosawa, you know, or it's from Hitchcock. It's from whoever. Right. For actors, especially, I think, for younger actors, like, now, like, if there's a 20-year-old actor out there now, do I think you need to watch movies from the 30s and 40s? No, but you need to be watching movies, because the conversation that I have with young actors is, they're like, oh, I don't watch movies. I don't watch TV.
What are you doing?
Sorry, guys, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
Right? That would be like someone that wants to do theater saying they don't watch theater. It's like, well...
Well, and when it works too, like you said, it's the collaborative process, like on Nobody, where, like, you've got these big stunt teams and Bob's asking and checking and being like, wait, so you, like, it's not just someone dictating, it's someone asking and processing and doing all that stuff. And I feel that when you don't watch it, you'll miss the opportunity to be like, well, they tried this in one of my favorite movies and maybe it works here, right? Like, if you're not watching what you're a part of, and I understand, like, you know, you hear, you know, the big names say, I don't watch myself. Well, but please watch something, right?
Like, yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting. So I have this conversation a lot with young actors, and when someone, sorry, sidebar, are you familiar with the four stages of learning model?
No, I know the five love languages though.
Okay, amazing. Well, there's, I think sending memes is one now. They're making
It made it
now.
all in there.
So just very, very quickly, the four stages of learning model. There's unconscious incompetence, conscious incompetence, unconscious, sorry, conscious competence, and then unconscious competence, right? So unconscious incompetence, this is where the Dunning-Kruger effect happens.
Dunning-Kruger got it. Okay.
Right? Yep. When people overestimate their knowledge in a field and underestimate how much knowledge there is in that field to know.
Yeah.
You can't skip a step here, right? So this is why everyone hates stage two. This is conscious incompetence. This is when you know how bad you are. So this is the stage where people usually quit. So someone that's interested in acting, they have no idea what's going on. They're like, oh yeah, I think I could do this. They go to their first class and go, oh no.
Fuck me.
Right? Then you've got people in stage three, which is conscious competence. So this is, you know, this is your craftsperson that's been working for a while that knows the job, right? And gets stuff done. But the fourth stage, this is the mastery stage. This is the 10,000 hour stage. This is unconscious competence, right? Michael Jordan's not thinking about a basket. He's not thinking about anything when he's doing it. Serena Williams, whatever, Meryl Streep. Like, we can talk about mastery in any field, yeah, right? But when someone says to you that they don't watch their films, they're already a master. And someone that's already a master doesn't need to watch because they've already seen and they've already learned the lesson. What is Harrison Ford going to learn from watching Shrinking? He's been working on camera for 50 years.
Yeah.
There are not infinite lessons to learn. But the problem is that young actors will go, oh, well, my favorite actor doesn't watch themselves, so I'm not going to watch myself. And that is a mistake.
100%, because they've watched themselves already. They're not talking about it anymore, but as much as they say they don't, they have, because you can only get better by figuring out where, you can only get better by playing a better opponent, even if that better opponent is your own self-conscious.
Yeah, I love that. And I think what we're talking about, like watching yourself on camera, what people have to understand is that all modern acting training sort of comes out of the Stanislavski school, right? And then you've got sort of three Americans that picked up on this and changed it, right? So you've got Adler, you've got Meisner, and you've got Strasberg, right? Very, very different. Interestingly enough, it's sort of Meisner and Strasberg that are, you know, sort of credited with, you know, everything.
You're the method, right? You hear Daniel Day-Lewis and method, and you just go.
Yeah, that's all Strasberg stuff. But like Adler was the only one that actually like trained directly under Stanislavski.
Yeah. I've heard that.
That's sort of interesting that they were saying like, no, you didn't understand. And she's the only one that actually went there. Anyway, regardless. So we don't have that sort of huge divide here in Canada. What was my point? What are we talking about?
We're talking about the different styles of acting. And how in America they prescribe to one style, and in theater they...
Oh, yes. Thank you. Welcome. Thank you. This is because I'm turning 47. So this is, my mom says this is normal. This is going to start
I'm right behind
happen.
You, man.
Yeah.
I forgot what I had for breakfast and if I'm wearing underwear, so don't feel bad.
Yeah, right. Exactly, right. What people need to understand is that your genetic makeup, your bone structure, the muscles in your face will determine what the camera picks up from you or not. It has nothing to do with what you are feeling inside. It's like, what is the camera able to see, right? Yeah. Because you'll have acting teachers, I think mistakenly, will tell young actors, oh, just have a thought. The camera can read your mind. No, it can't.
No.
It absolutely can't, right? And it also depends what's the size of shot. If it's an extreme close-up, well, you better put some of that thinking energy into the muscles around your eyes, right?
Micro
expressions, right? I would really love someone to delve into this. Now, I know phrenology is like not a real science, but it would be really interesting if someone would analyze sort of the top actors, the top Hollywood actors. I would love to know what the ratios are of their faces, if there's anything in that makes them more able to read. We know for a fact larger eyes are better. Larger heads are better.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
This is just a thing, right?
They feel so safe. And eyes are the window to the soul, right? One of the oldest sayings out there. So
yeah, absolutely.
Would present a bigger gateway into what that person was thinking.
Yeah. I mean, look at Anna Taylor-Joy, right?
Oh, yeah.
Very, very large eyes. Look at Margot Robbie, very, very large eyes, right? Anyway, the reason you need to watch yourself is you need to see if what you are feeling is translating into that performance. If it is, you don't have anything to worry about. If it's not, well, now you need to think about a different technique.
Yeah, start practicing. Right? Go back to that.
Yeah, because feeling it, my job as an actor is not to feel anything. My job is to make sure that you as the audience feel something.
Yeah, you're,
and if you
you're
take that pressure.
Yeah.
If you take that pressure off of yourself as a performer, it's so freeing, right? All young actors want to learn how to cry. How do I cry? It's like, bro, first of all, no, you're never going to have to do that. Like, don't, that's Meryl's job. That's Denzel's job. That's Bob Odenkirk's job. That's not my job. I'm never going to have to do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Don't worry. Don't worry about that.
But I mean, I imagine as this is something that, you know, even the skill sets that you develop physically that build a resume also pertain to who you are as a person and how you convey yourself. And like, it's as they say, meta, like there's a lot of moving parts to the benefits of all of that.
Sure. Yeah. No argument from me.
I stoned him, ladies and gentlemen. David, it's been an hour and a half, man. This went by so
Oh my God, has it really? This is why I can't I hope, man, we went on tangents. People should know Michael sent me this like crazy extensive list of questions, like, and I'm talking about stuff that I filmed like 15 years ago. You know what, Michael,
we're gonna do it again. It's a part two, obviously.
Well, I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about this, but it was really lovely because your questions let me think about stuff that I hadn't thought about in a very long time.
Great.
If I can, just for a minute,
yes, please.
There were two questions that I would like to talk about.
Okay.
So one question that you asked me, you said sort of who inspired you, you know, to become an actor.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So one of my teachers, two profs at the University of Alberta there, Jim DeFelice, who very sadly has passed away recently. He saw something in me when I don't think I even saw something in myself.
Right when he needed it.
Me in one of my first professional shows out of theater school. Just a lovely man, an absolute like theater titan in Canada. I've worked with his daughter Amy, you know, multiple times. And then Linda Rubin, who was my modern dance instructor. I don't know if she knows this, and she's not going to listen to this podcast, but she's the only reason that I made it through theater school. It was really, it's hard, man. When you're in your 20s and you're dealing with all these feelings and stuff, like it can be tumultuous, but dance, that was my rock through theater school. We had a great ballet instructor, Michael Hodges. I loved ballet. I only did it for a year. I wish I had done more of it.
Well, it teaches you grace and how to move your body. Like there's,
sure.
I think the backbone of any good dancer is, I mean, when you get to a level of dancing, you can take any choreography and learn.
I mean, 100%. Look at if anyone's watched So You Think You Can Dance, or So You Think You Can Dance Canada. Anyone with a strong ballet background was able to adapt to other styles. From people from other styles, the inverse was not true. So I think you're correct. One more thing very quickly.
Yes, please.
When I was on Stargate Atlantis, you asked about if there was any sort of experiences from set that really, really stuck with me.
Yeah.
So I was a villain. I was a guest star on an episode of Stargate Atlantis that happened to be a crossover episode with SG-1.
Wow.
So it was all the main cast from Atlantis and all the main actors from SG-1 as well.
Oh, wow. That must have been fun for them.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So I was at Crafty, standing behind the, like, Lou Gossett Jr., who happened to be there, like, shooting something
Iron
as well.
Eagle.
And then Amanda Tapping, who, of course, everyone knows was on SG-1, but then transitioned on to Atlantis. I mean, I don't know if people know, Amanda Tapping is the nicest human being in the world, right? You know. So here I am. I think I was, like, you know, 25, you know, pretty fresh out of theater school, pretty fresh, you know, moving to Vancouver. This was, you know, one of the biggest gigs I had done up until that date. She doesn't know me from Adam. There's no reason that she would, my scenes weren't with her. There's absolutely no reason for her to know my name. She comes up to me. I'm not in costume. I'm just standing around dressed like this. She goes, "Oh, hi, you're David. You're playing one of the replicators. I'm Amanda. Nice to meet you. Like, welcome." And like, I don't think people realize, you know, when you're a day player, it's every day is the first day of school.
Totally. You're there for a portion. You're not, you don't start, you don't end, you show up, you do your job.
Yeah. And everyone's got, and on a show like that, that had been running, I mean, SG1, I think, had already been running for 4 or 5 years and it was still running. And this was running sort of concurrently. So you've got a really tight crew, a really tight cast, right? So that can be very difficult. So Amanda Tapping, I love you. That memory will stick with me forever. And then Paul McGillion, who was also in the cast, I had a scene. He wasn't even on camera. I'm talking to Richard Dean Anderson and like the other replicators. He's kind of just off camera. And we shot the wide for this scene. And I look over at him. He's just kind of sitting up against the wall. And he just goes like this.
That's all.
And he was, there were a couple of instances where he was just like, just supportive in that way. He didn't say anything, but I felt supported. And again, these guys are busy, man. They don't have time for this. Right. But he took the time. Sidebar, when I was on Reacher in season two of Reacher, I was working with an actor who is really good friends with Paul McGillion. And so I told him this story.
The moment
he called Paul, so we were able to like relate this story to him. So it was this really wonderful.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, this really wonderful like full circle moment. So yeah, I hope if I am ever in a situation like that, that I'm able to extend that type of care.
Yeah,
because we were talking about something. This was 15, 17 years ago. And like, it's living rent free in my mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, you're right. They don't have to do that, but they also know they were there once too. It's the people who remember, like when they were put over, they remember who put them over. Right. And then there's other people who just forget where they came from. And that's unfortunate. And that's what creates dicks.
Yeah. I should say that like literally everyone I have worked with in this industry are lovely people. You know what I mean? I have not had any experience with any of these horror stories that you hear about, which I, you know, I'm sure some of them are real, but I'm sure some of them are blown out of proportion or taken out of context.
You don't know what you don't know, right? Like, so until you're in it, it's anecdotal and it muddies the waters for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, Michael, thank you so much. I really wanted to touch on those because those questions, they really move me. And thank you for doing all of that research. Like, again, there's no reason for you to look that far down, you know, on my resume. But again, someone like me that's, you know, sort of still trying to do the thing, like that means a lot that you would do that. So thank you for
that. Like you said, you're like, you do a lot of supporting roles. I mean, there's no small parts. We've all heard that. Right. And I mean, that's, you know, to the janitor who plays janitor too, they might argue, but what I'm saying is that I'm always interested in the story behind how you experienced it or how it was for you, because that's where the fandom lives, right? That's where the experience lives. So it's not so much about whatever's on screen. It's about what you remember in that moment. And I know most movie fans always love knowing a little personal nugget of something that they've seen. They get to peek behind the curtain and see what Oz was doing that day. And that's what moves me. I like the sausage. I like how it all happens. So hearing stories about conversing with people who don't need to talk to you and fighting with Bob, like however big it is, it's huge to me because it's a big moment in someone's career. That's how I'm looking at it. I'm not looking at it as a credit. I'm not looking at it as a above the line. I'm looking at it as, no, this person did this and I want to know about it. And there's a story to it. It doesn't matter if it's not Bob's story. It's your story.
No, I appreciate that. And it's true. And I think we forget that, right? This industry is a ladder and nobody's looking down.
No. Yeah. It's what did you do for me today? Not what did you do for me 10 years ago?
Yeah. Everyone's looking up that ladder. And so what's nice about, you know, if you ever have to write your resume or, you know, if you're sort of looking at the old credits, then these stories sort of come up and you can say to yourself, oh, right, I have been doing this for over 20 years. You know, I do have, you know, 60 plus credits. You know, that's an achievement. You know what I mean? So it's, you don't have to hate where you are to want to change. And it's okay to give yourself credit for the work that you've done. And and I suppose this is sort of a very Canadian thing, but like, it's okay to feel proud. It's
100%.
It's just, I've done the work.
Pathetic, man. Like, I look at your resume and I mean, you've done so much. You've experienced so much. You've seen so much that, like, whenever that moment is for you to, I mean, I consider you an artist, but when, by your definition, when you get to be the artist in the scene, like a Denzel or the point is, when you're at the dance, I know you'll be the artist that you already are.
Well, I appreciate that. And actually, I shot a short film last year, premiered at the Dead Center Film Festival here in Oklahoma. Okay. That's the only time I felt like super artistic. I'll send you a link. It's on Vimeo.
Yeah, I'll watch it for sure. I'll watch anything.
Check it out. Yeah.
Listener, if you want to see Dave next.
Yes. So currently in theaters is still Nobody 2.
Yep.
That's still running for probably a couple more weeks.
Yeah.
I just shot a day on November 1963.
Yeah.
So that's with Travolta and Dermot Mulroney. And the scene I got to do was with Jefferson White, who's playing Lee Harvey Oswald. Nice.
Yellowstone.
Dude, he is just
great. He's DM'd me before. I have, like, when, because he's one of my favorite storylines. Everyone always gave his storyline shit on Yellowstone. I was like, no, this is the guy who's trying to be like everybody else. Like, I prescribe to that line of thinking. I could never be a cowboy, so he's thinking the same thing. But he's really solid.
Yeah, people are gonna lose their minds over his performance. I think that's coming out
next year.
And then I just found out yesterday that I'm going to be in Violent Night 2.
Oh, dude.
So I can't even tell you how excited I am. I can't tell you anything more than that.
I don't have enough money to cover a lawsuit.
So that's super exciting. Again, it's another 87 North production. Yeah. I'm so grateful, to get to work with these guys. That's going to be great. If people haven't seen the first one, they really should. It's great. David Harbour is incredible.
Classic now in my household.
Yeah, right?
Fuck Die Hard. It's Violent Night.
Yeah, 100%. My new go-to for Christmas movies, I don't know if you've seen 8-Bit Christmas.
No, but you're in it.
I am. It's based on the novel, which is actually a really good novel, but we're close in age, right?
Yeah. We're off.
So this novel, it's about this group of like 10-year-old kids that are desperate to get the Super Nintendo for Christmas. It's Christmas 1988.
Oh, shit. I didn't know that was the plot.
Yeah. So reading that novel and seeing that movie was like, I don't know if you read Ready Player One.
No, I watched it a ton of times, but I never read it.
Bro, you got to read the book. It's just, it was like my childhood was just being like spit at me rapid fire. And 8-Bit Christmas is great. So that's my, and of course Die Hard and Batman Returns, because I'm not an idiot.
Well, yeah. To anybody out there, if you didn't get the memo, Batman Returns is a Christmas movie, because
100% confirmed,
right? Listener, if you want to find out all of Dave's credits, the IMDb link is in the show notes, so you can go down a rabbit hole like I have. If you want to reach out to him, all of his social media will be there. I will email him a link after, and he'll fill it all out and send me everything he needs to know. Besides that, dude, thank you again. Like, I love that we just did this. This is what I was kind of hoping for, and this was great. So thank you.
No, thank you. This was really great. I'm going to continue listening to the podcast. I love the banter and the back and forth. I got to finish episode 291 right now. I don't think we've gotten to any bobsticles yet. I'm waiting for those.
What did I do? I pitched a reality cooking show that was also sketch comedy called Soul Food.
People can't, if they can't see me right now, that was a very enjoyable lean back. I'm all for a good pun.
So this has been another Real Debaters podcast, listener. If this is your first time, you should go backwards. There's a ton of episodes, including other interviews with local Manitoba talents, which Dave now is as of 18 months. You are now a true 204 Manitoban. You can follow all his stuff, as mentioned. I have nothing else for you. David, tell everybody, what's your favorite movie right now? What's the last good movie you watched?
Oh, my God. The last... I'll tell you what I'm looking forward to. I want to see Weapons.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Barbarian was...
Brilliant.
Absolute banger of a film.
Oh, that right turn in the middle of the movie, that's like, Where are we going with this?
What's going on? So I want to see weapons. And of course, Kreger is going on to do, he's doing the new Resident Evil.
Yes. Yes.
Which I think would be super, super exciting. Of course, I want to see The Beekeeper 2, because of course, Timo's directing that. And then you've got Jason Statham in that. And then I don't know if people know this, Bob Odenkirk shot another movie immediately after Nobody 2. It's called Normal.
He did.
Yeah. And so that there's like, that's a really interesting script. There's going to be some good action in that as well. Yeah. So those are sort of, and then I've got so many films on my list. Like we talked about, like I got to rewatch 2001, A Space Odyssey. That's
no, Dave.
I have to. I saw it when I was like 14 and I was expecting Star Wars and it wasn't, and I didn't enjoy it. And
do
it's like,
you understand the ending?
Well, this is the thing. It's like reading Chekhov in your 20s. You're not going to get it. It's not meant for you.
Nope.
You know what I mean? And so now that I'm, you know, past middle age, I think maybe it'll, you know, resonate now.
All right. This is like Lord of the Rings. This is like the third time we're ending this shit.
Okay. I'm sorry. You keep.
Oh, this dude, is it's me. It's like, not you.
I appreciate it, man.
Don't apologize. You're Canadian, but don't be apologetic.
That's right. Oh, my God. I learned nothing.
Watch all the movies, kids. Say bye, Dave.
Okay. Bye, guys. Right. Thanks for having me.
If you have any problems, dial information. Thank you for calling.